understand what the problem is here.
With Carmichael Dave, Katie Christensen, and Nate Goodyear.
New morning, team.
Put the top down. Rev your engine.
Say, what goes on this morning?
Welcome to the drive.
I don't know if I want to say, wow, I really respect that about you, or if I want to say, gosh, that is so stupid.
Come on, man. Wake the up. The drive. The drive.
He needs to shut his mouth.
Here we go with Dave, Katie, and Nate.
That keg is almost tapped.
Yeah.
And they're going to get every last drop out of it.
Broadcasting live from the Coors Light Studios. Coors Light, with great beer comes great responsibility. Now the drive continues with Dave, Katie, and Nate.
It is a Hall of Fame Thursday. Why is it a Hall of Fame Thursday? Well, we have not just one, but two, Hall of Famers.
Dose.
Coming on the old program, Larry Merchant will join us at the bottom of the hour.
I feel like we had a third Hall of Famer on deck that we could probably swing later.
Huh?
I think we could probably interview, like, I don't know, Secretariat or something like that.
Do something like
here
that.
On a Horse Thursday.
It's cow Thursday.
That was close.
Nate's having a show.
Did you know that cattle actually have
Hall of Fame status for another day?
Larry Merchant and Nancy Lee.
I haven't even had my first cup of scotch yet.
Cattle actually have an excellent sense of smell.
Do they?
You know that? They can. You would think that they would use them, like, you know, law enforcement when they're tracking people, but they can detect odors from up to 5 miles away.
Oh my God!
And they can also hear both low and high frequency sounds beyond human capability.
Really?
Yes.
Like a doggy.
You know, and they're still completely worthless.
I'm assuming not.
Oh, bite your
tongue.
For anything other than food.
And milk, which is food. And companionship.
I don't think that they're worthless at all, because technically, before machinery, they did all of the farm work.
And leather.
In the wild, cows are useless. That's what I'm saying. Cows would have been phased out by evolution like generations ago. But we got to eat. Humans got to eat their food.
Yeah.
I mean,
yes, they do.
The hell,
Nate,
guys.
What is wrong with you today? This is what happens when Nate plays an evening softball game and doesn't get enough rest. Dave was
delirious.
Grumpy cat yesterday, and you are a freaking grumpy cat times 10 today.
I'm grumpy.
No, you're not grumpy. You're just snarky.
Snarkier. Snarky cat.
Although, when you brought up the sense of smell the cows have, that put a very funny thought in my head of police cows. Like, they have canines, but if they had cownines, they took them to crime scenes on a leash and they released Bessie.
I'm sure that they would if the cleanup wasn't more labor intensive.
Oh, because dogs
poop too.
Yeah, but it's nothing like a cow.
No, one's a chip and one's a log.
It's not even a log, it's a patty.
And they'd be able to have milk for their donuts.
Thank you.
Oh, look at you.
Dip donuts in milk.
Yeah, donuts and milk are fine.
Work, right?
Yeah,
I mean, most people do it in coffee, I'm assuming. I'm not a dipper of anything. I don't like to dip my food into...
I don't dip. I bite and drink the same mouthful.
My dad, actually, he does, like, cake. He doesn't just eat a piece of cake. He puts it in a bowl and puts milk over it.
That's a baller move right there.
Wait. He puts a piece of cake in a bowl and then
puts piece of cake in a bowl and puts milk on it. And then also, when he does ice cream, he puts
milk
on
that.
That's fine. That's just milkshakey.
Yeah, it is. But it's kind of
deconstructed
cool.
Milkshake.
It's kind of cool what it does. It like gives you the like milk ice chips type thing. It's pretty.
Like Oreos, people will dunk their Oreos and then they have Oreo milk,
that's
and I hate that.
That's the only thing I have.
What?
I
hate that.
Dunk Oreos.
I hate Oreo milk.
That is the whole point of
I take
dunking.
A bite of my Oreo. Well, a bite of my Oreo. I'm a fat pig. I put the whole Oreo in my mouth and then I drink milk in my mouth and then I chew it with the milk and swallow it.
So, true story. Yesterday, I was talking to you about going and meeting with this fitness place. And we were
going, like, did she just go to the gym yesterday and you guys keep dancing around it? Or what is going on?
No, she met with a prospective endorsement.
Yes.
That happens to be a gym.
And we were talking about the show and this guy's like, is Dave fat?
Wait, the gym guy said that?
He goes, is Dave fat? You know, because this is what I said, like, the good thing about this is actually something I would use, whereas if you were asking...
This is a load, by the way. I told them to set me up with a gym a long time ago.
Look at you!
Hey, shut up. Hey, guess what? You have a Traeger.
And
I've been telling them to set me up with that for like 4 years.
You got a Traeger and a truck. Hey, they gave you McDonald's. They're trying to help you out.
I know. What?
People love this.
Yeah, we're trying to put the meat on it.
Hey, it's radio people fighting over their endorsements. 339-1140. Really, what endorsement would you want?
Seriously. I was telling him, I was like, I'll actually use this. Whereas if Dave were sitting in this chair, he might go for a week.
Of what?
Of like to the gym.
Oh, yeah, about a week.
Yeah.
Maybe.
That's like your...
That's why I've never had a... I had a Max Muscle endorsement. It was hilarious because I'd be like, hey...
Carmichael
Dave sent you in. And then like the next hour, Carmichael Dave from Mount Mike's Pizza. Then the next hour, it's Carmichael Dave for liposuction.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm a
but
whore.
But it's true. I was like, no, man. I said, he's not fat.
You said that?
I said he is not fat. Well, he's self-deprecating.
So you're starting off your relationship with a potential endorser by lying to them. Well done, Katie.
Dave, you're not fat.
Just big boned. Remember the dumb sports radio conversation we had yesterday, the Showtime Lakers versus the old Warriors and all that? Yes, it's a stupid conversation, but it's what
is
we
it,
do. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar weighed in on that.
Wow. The Showtime team had guys on that team who could defend on the perimeter. Guys don't go to college now. They don't learn how to play defense out away from the basket. It's an offensive game now.
Okay, but what about Shaquille O'Neal, who wasn't a Showtime Laker?
I don't think it's that guys don't learn. Guys don't care. The game has changed to the point
I'm
where...
I'm just tired of all the nonsense about, like, that's not even relevant to the comment. Guys don't go to college and they don't learn.
So they don't learn how to defend.
Are you telling me that guys in the NBA don't play defense? Like, that is not what I watched in the finals last night. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Like, these guys learn how to defend. It doesn't matter if that's not relevant.
There was a segment, there was a play right before halftime where... Klay Thompson was absolutely denied all over the floor. And I'm like, who the heck is that, right? It was number 13. It was too far. It wasn't a close-up, so I couldn't see the name on the jersey. Tristan Thompson.
Yep.
Who was their low-key MVP
defending
yesterday.
Defending him on the perimeter, denying. Yep. They tried so many times to take advantage of that mismatch situation. Yeah. And Klay Thompson could not for the life of him see daylight.
I've always said this. Like if you think, especially in this day and age, that, I mean, yeah, there are NBA teams that don't play defense. But if you think the whole game is filled with guys that don't play defense, you're doing a huge disservice to the offense,
it's
the level of offensive skill and the things these guys can do.
We'll tell you what Shaquille O'Neal said about the Showtime Lakers. We also have sound from yesterday's finals. We'll hear from Tyronn Lue on Kevin Love, Steve Kerr on what he thought happened to his team, and much more next with Larry Merchant at the bottom of the hour. It's The Drive, Sports 1140 KHDK. .722 Sports 1140 KHDK. The Drive, Dave, Katie, and Nate. Larry Merchant will join us at 7:30. Boxing Hall of Famer. We'll talk to him about the life and times of Muhammad Ali. And then Nancy Lieberman, speaking of Ali, will be out there for the funeral.
She will.
And who was very close with the greatest. She'll come on. We'll talk to her about that.
With the greatest.
Yes.
I feel like
I see what
you're
saying.
Great people just kind of hang out together, right?
There's a club.
There's a greatest club. Yeah. They have jackets and everything.
We are awaiting our invites in the mail.
Yeah. Stand by that mailbox. So Kareem Abdul-Jabbar weighed in on the whole Showtime thing. But we'll just tell you, before we get back into the finals from last night, Shaquille O'Neal was not a part of the Showtime Lakers.
No.
Okay. But he decided he was going to weigh in. The whole Showtime versus...
What did he weigh in at? Like 350?
About 380.
Okay.
Here's Shaq on the whole Warriors-Showtime, who's better situation.
A lot of people like to talk about Showtime. Showtime was a great team, but the best Laker team is a team that almost went 16-0, the 15-1 team. You know, a lot of people don't like to mention that team.
So there's that.
I was just, you know, as soon as you brought it up, it's like, I know that they didn't quite have the lengthy run, and there was always kind of, you know, some sort of controversy, or, you know, whether it was Shaq and Kobe not getting along, or, you know, Phil just kind of generally being a weirdo, you know, whatever it might be. I don't look at any of these teams and see them having an answer for Shaq.
Well, Kareem agrees with you.
They play this, you know, what do they call it? Small ball. Size really matters on the court, even in an era like now with small ball. If you have somebody who can score inside, that creates serious problems for the defense. So imagine if Shaq was playing against the Golden State. I don't think they could do anything with him.
Nobody could ever do anything with him. I mean,
You don't think Andrew Bogut and Draymond Green could stop Shaq?
The only
they would just send him to the free throw line. That is the one thing with
and he'd
Shaq.
Hit him when it mattered.
Of course.
Because he always did. The only guy that ever had any sort of hope against Shaq was Vlade. I mean, seriously, like when you look back, that's why those teams were so competitive, is because number one, Vlade was the only guy that could even physically come close to Shaq, and he couldn't, but Vlade's a giant human being.
He is.
He's like the and only thing that could even come close to an answer, and they still couldn't stop
love
him.
Or hate flopping?
Perfect. It was an art.
It is, and it's a valuable thing in a situation like that.
Yeah,
when you're going up against a physically dominant person, to be able to sell that and use it to your advantage, it gives you a shot.
The thing that was underrated, I thought, about Vlade's defense on Shaq was that Vlade also knew most of the time he was very good at rationing his fouls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he would use his fouls, and in every game he'd play against the Lakers, he'd have five fouls or he'd foul out in the fourth quarter or something. He'd get closer, but he'd ration them correctly, and they would send Shaq to the free throw, which is weird when you think about it, that they would foul Shaq so much, and it's called Hack-a-Shaq.
It was before.
Coincidentally.
It was kind of before that, though. That wasn't, Hack-a-Shaq didn't come until later in his career when Vlade was already done.
Speaking of Shaquille O'Neal, he was talking about how his Lakers would do against the Warriors.
Today's rules would kill him, because just like you can't hand check Steph Curry, can't hand check Kobe either. And a Bogut would have been Australian barbecue chicken.
I feel like Andrew Bogut would have done to Shaq what Scott Pollard used to do to Shaq, which was get broken. And that's no offense to Scott.
That was his job, basically.
That was his job. Yeah. Scott Pollard took massive abuse from Shaq, and Scott Pollard was six fouls and try to stand your ground.
Yeah.
That's how Bogut would be.
I'm so irritated. I would like just once for one of these guys to pipe up and say, why are we talking about this?
Come on, that's
not going
to happen. It'll never happen. We're never going to be able to see these teams square off against each other. Why can't we just say that they're the best right now?
Sure.
Can you ever see the game? I mean, we talk about some of these all-time greats like Kareem or whatever it might be, and you know, past eras, especially when you get in guys like Oscar Robertson, whatever, where the game has evolved past them, and we still have respect to them. It's like, yeah, those guys couldn't play now. Number one, do you think the game will ever evolve to the point where you would say that about LeBron? And number two, would it ever? It's never going to happen with Shaq, right?
I wouldn't think so, and it would take about 80 years. And assuming that we have the same evolution from 1950 to 2016 that we would 2016 to 2072. And I don't think that's the case. Unless we have players in 2072 that are literally jumping into the rafters.
That are like combinations of Shaq and LeBron.
Yes. And sneakers are developed that actually let you fly. I don't know how much more. There's going to be evolution. But I don't know how much more. And Katie, to your point, I think there's an interesting conversation here. Why are we having that? Why do people talk about it? Why do people bring this up? Why can't we? The reason is because sports are stupid. It's just they're stupid, and we're stupid,
no,
and we have stupid conversations.
Sports are not stupid.
Here's the thing:
we are stupid.
There are levels of stupid. When you think about it, you break sports down to their core. What sports have? We all sit around, we're voyeurs, we're not on the floor, we're sitting and watching other people and talking for 3 hours about what other people do with a ball in a basket. Okay, that's dumb, but we love it. It's our thing, it's our escape, it's what we're into, we're passionate about it. It's the same thing with these conversations. Your point is logical. You make sense when you say that, but this is how people drink beer at a sports bar and have the three-hour conversation,
Dave,
about what would Babe Ruth do in the 90s.
Right, how do we know how
argument.
Good the Warriors are if we can't contextualize it in any way?
There's no room for conversation.
I understand your argument in that sense. But guess what? I played the game, and I wasn't a Shaq type. Seriously, I played the game, and I wasn't a Shaq type player. And maybe that's why. Maybe it's the greats that when they're done, they need to be able to continue to have that kind of rush of like, yeah, I'm freaking great. I'm amazing. And no one in any time frame, at any time period, I don't care what's going on, how good they are, they're never going to be as great as me.
Yeah, spend more time in Santa Barbara.
BS. I'm gonna tell you this right now. As a player, I'm never going to sit there and be like, I was better than her. The game, our teams were better than that. Shut the hell up. Appreciate what is going on in the sport. Give them their credit. Keep your mouth closed. I'm so sick and tired of this conversation. And I love Shaq to death. The only good thing that came out of that is the barbecue chicken, freaking skewer or whatever, Australian chicken.
What year did you guys win the NBA WNBA title?
2007, the year after I left.
Yeah. Oh, I thought so you weren't on that team.
I was not on that team. I left the next year.
Wow.
I left
Man. But my point is this. You didn't lead the WNBA in scoring for 5 or 6 or 7 straight years, yeah. And you didn't play on one of the greatest WNBA teams of all time. You didn't play on a WNBA team that even won a title. My point is this. 25 years from now, if the WNBA was at the level the NBA is with the type of media scrutiny and all that, though I believe you that you wouldn't talk like that, I think it's a little bit different when you have pillars of the game with rings and scoring championships and Hall of Fame careers behind them. When they're challenged and asked a question, that competitive part of them is going to make them have
it's
to respond.
It's not competitive. It's arrogant. And it's foolish.
Well, being competitive can also have a little bit of arrogance and ego and self-worth and narcissism.
Okay, so go at it this way. Go at it and say, you know what? They're a great team. I think that it would be difficult because of this reason, that reason, whatever. It always comes back to a me-centric argument for them.
Yeah.
Me.
This
I'm
just
better.
In, athletes have egos.
Oh, it's
Film at 11.
It's exhausting.
You're
and it's nauseating.
You're nauseating. We'll take a break.
Shut up!
We'll come back with Larry Merchant. It's The Drive. Sports 1140 KHDK.
You're coming cold.
Goodbye.
You're covered in blood. They're all so happy.
Joining us right now on The Drive, what an honor, and I mean this as the highest form of compliment, shortly after the news that Muhammad Ali had passed away, in my mind, having done radio for a long time, guys, there were two men that I honestly, that I wished I could talk to about Muhammad Ali, one of them for obvious reasons not available, Burt Sugar, and the other, Boxing Hall of Famer, Larry Merchant, who joins us right now. Larry, I'm Dave with Katie and Nate. Thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
I'm doing well. Ali lived his singular life out. He wouldn't have done it any other way. And as another greatest Mr. Shakespeare put it, good night, sweet prince, may angels sing thee to thy rest.
Larry, can you even put into words, if I were to say to you, if you had to pick one thing that stands out to you about the life and times of Muhammad Ali, is that even a possible question to answer?
No, because the times themselves were so unusual, so complicated, with people marching in anti-war demonstrations, in civil rights demonstrations, in feminist demonstrations. The environmental movement was beginning, and we had sex, drugs, and rock and roll as never before. And along comes this special athlete and showman, and he both represents the times and becomes an important mover and shaker of the times.
Larry Merchant joining us on KHTK. Larry, sometimes you see guys whose athletic achievements are inflated a bit by things they've done outside the lines. And Muhammad Ali was one of the rare breeds that was kind of at the pinnacle of both politically and athletically. But as someone in myself that didn't get to experience Muhammad Ali as the fighter in real time, what can you do to put his career as a boxer into perspective so that people like me understand, like, no, believe me, he was also an all-time great boxer?
Well, first, there were many skeptics about him as a heavyweight. He had won the gold medal as a light heavyweight because we had never seen anyone so big and fast and graceful and intuitive and athletic in the ring. And he wasn't even accepted by many of the establishment people in boxing, the veteran writers, etc., until after he came back from the political exile he was thrown into because he was a conscientious objector to the war in Vietnam. And we saw not only his other skills, but his extraordinary fierce will as a fighter, his toughness as a fighter. And just remember this. People ask me, well, was he the greatest? Was he the best heavyweight of all time? And I understand that. But the only answer I have is he fought Frazier 3 times, Ken Norton 3 times, Liston twice, Patterson twice. Other tough guys of the time, Terrell and Shavers and Jerry Quarry twice. And all the while, he had stirred emotions and opposition because of his style as a showman. No one had ever seen an athlete be able to use the media the way he did and have the fun the way he did and then change his religion and then become an anti-war protester. And ultimately, because of all that, an ambassador for the country that the rest of the world could hardly believe their eyes and ears that a black guy could do this in America. And he was literally an ambassador for the country. So he was an extraordinary figure at an extraordinary time. And they met, the Times and Ali met each other.
Larry Merchant joining us on The Drive this morning. Larry, I saw an interview that he did years ago with Barbara Walters, and she asked him, what did he not like about himself? And his answer was that he was lazy and had the propensity to be overweight. Do you think we ever saw the full potential of Muhammad Ali as a boxer?
Sure we did. As he went on in his career, like a lot of fighters, he sometimes became complacent before a fight. Stories about him, you know, eating a dozen eggs for breakfast and bowls of ice cream and such. I remember when he fought Chuck Wepner, who was a kind of a tough journeyman heavyweight later in his career. I think the fight was in Cleveland. And I wrote afterwards that he trained for the first half of the fight and fought in the second half of the fight. And, yeah, there were times when he let himself go. But that kind of self-criticism also helped to drive him. If an opponent showed up who he respected or feared, you can be pretty sure that he'd be in the best shape he could get in at that stage of his life and career.
Larry Merchant joining us on KHDK. And Larry, being born in the late 70s, I too did not get a chance to see Ali in his prime. Growing up, though, like many kids with their fathers, my dad would guide me through Ali's career. And more importantly, my dad would tell me stories before YouTube of his relationship with Howard Cosell, how that relationship was unique and how they helped each other in the American consciousness. Could you talk a little bit about that and what was so unique about Cosell and Ali?
Well, early in Ali's career, when he was such a provocative character, simply because he was such a great entertainer, he understood that a professional athlete was not just an athlete, not even just an entrepreneur, but also an entertainer. And he had a rare ability and desire and need to entertain, whether it was one person in front of him or a billion people out there. And that rubbed a lot of people wrong. That was not the way an athlete was supposed to be. And of course, his trash talking and his rhyming, while it amused many of us, it made a lot of people crazy. What's going on here? And so that's why he got he became a symbol of the change that was in the air. From the get-go, he was fighting opposition, and then after he beat Sonny Liston and won the championship, questions about the fight, and he reveals that he has become, joined the Nation of Islam, a Christian who had become a Muslim. And so even before his outright political statements about the war and such, people didn't know what to make of him, and many people were rooting to get his big mouth shut by somebody. And Cosell was one, had a national forum, and he interviewed Ali, and Ali showed the quickness of his mind and his humor in being able to respond, and Cosell got it, and so they had an act that went back and forth together. I remember one part of it was Cosell complimenting him on his the quickness of his mind, and Ali looking at him and saying, "You're not so dumb either, Howard." And it was a good act, and having a national forum, it did help both of them, helped people who really didn't know Ali to see how he was under fire and how his humor struck everybody, and of course it helped Cosell. Now Cosell had some bombast of his own and would always claim he was the only one to take Ali's side in the legal issues of his conscientious objection, but actually there were many of us in the media who supported Ali, and in some ways there was a generational divide. The younger guys like me got him. Many of the older scribes didn't quite get him.
Boxing Hall of Famer Larry Merchant with us on The Drive. Larry, I want to go back to 1980, Muhammad Ali's fight and Larry Holmes. And in retrospect, a lot of people kind of point to that as something that he shouldn't have done. And even when he did, that the fight went on for far too long and you could just see how much he deteriorated. My question is, do you think that that fight actually had a long-term effect on his health, or is that just retrospectively kind of 2020 to look back and say, well, yeah, of course, it's an easy scapegoat for his declining health?
Well, there are already people claiming he was in declining health before the fight, and it couldn't have done him any good, let's put it that way. Larry Holmes is a hell of a fighter, and Ali absorbed a lot of punishment. But he had absorbed tremendous punishment in what is probably the greatest heavyweight fight ever, the third fight with Frazier and other fighters. I sort of flipped out that roster of opponents that he had. And while early in his career he didn't take a whole lot of direct hits, later he did, and showed us a side of him that nobody knew was there. And I just want to emphasize again that that's what fighters normally do. When they have the marquee value of an Ali, some promoter is always offering them more money than they can conceivably make in any other way. They are defined by their boxing careers. It's how they live their lives. And when they look in the mirror, they don't look 33 or 38 compared to the average person. They still look at themselves and think they're 24 or 28. And it's understandable. It's part of the arc of a great champion's career. Very, very few have walked away at a time when there was still a lot of money and quite a bit of fight left in them.
the private services for Muhammad Ali are later today. And then, of course, tomorrow, Friday, there will be the public funeral services. And Bill Clinton, Billy Crystal, just a couple to name, that are going to be delivering the eulogies for Muhammad Ali. Larry, I'm curious, with your time and your experience with Muhammad Ali, is there a favorite story about him that you can convey to us?
Well, there are countless, but one that I've been telling is that on the flight to Zaire for the fight with George Foreman, who at that time was thought to be an invincible force, who might really hurt Ali, that this might be Ali's last hurrah. And remember, this was in the second part of Ali's career. First, he got on the mic from the cockpit and started having fun with the fact that the both pilots were black. And whoever heard of being flown by black pilots, and were they going to land us safely, and just having the most fun and having us rolling in the aisles. And then he comes out and he sits down next to me and he says these words: if he doesn't get me in seven, his parachute won't open. And what he was saying was, yes, he understood the risk and danger of fighting Ali, Foreman, but he wasn't scared for himself the way a lot of other people were. He saw Foreman as a fighter, and he saw that the crack in his armor was his stamina. And to me, that was the basis for the famous rope-a-dope strategy that he actually improvised early in the fight, because he saw that he was not going to be able to just move away from George, that he was trapped on the ropes. And the thought occurred to him, okay, I'll sit here and see how this goes. Now, nobody else would have come up with that strategy against George Foreman, and surely nobody else could have executed it, even if they did. But he stood in there and blocking most punches and taking some heavy shots, particularly on the arms and shoulders, shots that would have broken a lot of people's arms and shoulders. And gradually, George Foreman defeated himself. The rounds went on, and the volleys of punches became fewer, and Ali started whipping out a jab here, a combination there. And sure enough, George Foreman's parachute didn't open, and in the eighth round, Ali knocked him out.
There's a famous video going around lately of Ali dodging 21 punches in 10 seconds. Larry Merchant, last thing for you. Dempsey, Tunney, Lewis, Marciano, Ali, arguably even Tyson. Larry, once upon a time, the heavyweight championship of the world was the most coveted championship in all of sports. And I'm sure you get tired of the "is boxing dead" questions and blah, blah, blah. My question for you is this: with Ali's passing especially, can you see a time in the future in sports where the heavyweight belt will ever mean the same that it used to?
Unlikely. But Ali was unlikely. You wouldn't know this either, but Ali came along at a time when the sport was starting to go down from mainstream, okay? And people were concerned about it, but Ali showed that he could attract such huge crowds and television numbers, et cetera, that in a sense, he re-kickstarted its popularity. That said, It's interesting to me that there are a number of outstanding young heavyweights around at the moment, that the heavyweight division will be having its moments in the next couple of years. But it's more of the sport is more of a global sport now than it was then. Americans don't dominate it the way they once did. But being heavyweight champion of the world no longer symbolizes that you are the strongest person in the world, that nobody in the world could beat you. But somebody exciting will come along. There's a young American named Deontay Wilder, mm-hmm. Who's got a record of, something like 36-0 with 35 knockouts. There are a couple of outstanding British heavyweights and a few others here and there who will start meeting. So, no, it's not what it once was. But for a handful or a few million followers of the game, it's still important and big, but it's not normally front page stuff anymore. So that's just how times change. And whatever we think now is going to go on forever, trust me, it'll change.
Well, and then I have to ask you, two of the top three when it comes to reigning champions, heavyweight champions, are Vladimir and his brother Vitaly Klitschko. Vladimir, number one, days as champion with Joe Louis sandwich in the middle. In your mind, Larry, as maybe the foremost boxing historian there is, do they deserve to be in the same breath as some of those other all-time great heavyweight champions?
Look, all any athlete in any sport can do is be the best in his time. Times change. The heavyweights today, like the NFL linemen or the NBA forwards, are bigger and more athletic and stronger than ever before. Dempsey weighed 188 pounds. Klitschko weighs 243. Is that a fair fight? I don't know. Dempsey beat some big guys, as did Joe Louis, who weighed a little over 200. So everybody has to be perceived, I think, in their time. And while it's interesting talk stuff about who was this and that, I mean, Tyson couldn't beat Buster Douglas. So how does that? But he was an exciting imperative at the time, and people bring his name up more than Evander Holyfield, who knocked him out twice. So I don't take all of that seriously. Nobody really knows. But as we started this discussion, the roster of opponents that Ali fought is unmatched in heavyweight history.
Well, we get paid to do this job, but there's days that I would happily pay to do this job. This is one of those. Larry Merchant, huge fan of yours my entire life. Thank you for joining us. I could talk to you all day. Appreciate your time.
Could I just add one thing?
Yes, sir, please.
From the greatest, Mr. Shakespeare, to the greatest, Muhammad Ali, good night, sweet prince. May flights of angels sing thee to thy rest.
Couldn't have said it better. Larry.
Thank you, Larry. You take care.
Thank you.
Thank you. That is the great Hall of Famer, Larry Merchant. And yes, if it was up to me and we didn't have to do commercials, I could literally talk to him until about 5, 6, 7 o'clock this afternoon, evening, until somebody, not me, fell asleep. Probably most likely him getting bored of me. We are way late for a break. It was absolutely worth it. We'll take that now. It is The Drive, Sports 1140 KHTK.